You're listening to Alien X Radio, and this is your afternoon interview. On the line right now, I've got my guest for today. You might know her, of course, from the movie E.T. or The Howling or Cujo. It's the very fabulous and the delightful Dee Wallace. How are you doing today?
I'm fabulous, darling, just like you said.
She is delightful. Yeah, I bring up that delightful because I had spoke to Belinda Blasky. She was one of my guests in the past.
Oh, isn't she an awesome lady?
She really is. It was a fantastic interview, and she had nothing but great things to say about you. I had mentioned that I had seen you a couple times at Motor City Nightmares here in Detroit, but I hadn't had an opportunity to talk to you, and she said that's a shame because Dee is a delight, she said.
Oh, well, we have a mutual admiration society, which you can join now. And isn't the Motor City Nightmares, that's a great show, isn't it?
Absolutely. I've been, I think, the last 4 years straight I've been there.
Well, you better come by and say hi this time.
Oh, absolutely. I have no excuse now.
Okay.
Yeah,
it's a deal.
Yeah, this last time I ran over and I had to talk to Michael Rooker. I had him on my show. He was there this past year with you.
Yeah, I know.
So that was
awesome. It's just a great show, and Tommy and Todd are good friends of mine, too. We've done a movie or two together, and they're just really great people. I love them. So we'll have to invite all of your listeners to come by next year when we have it. I don't know what the date is next year. It's usually in the spring, right?
Well, I haven't seen any releases yet either. Exactly as to when it is. And I never pay attention. I just know, you know, when it's coming out, I got to go.
Yeah.
I can't even tell you, like, what time of the year it normally is. I just got to go.
Well, you better come see me next time, dude.
Oh, absolutely. So, Dee, tell me a little bit about Dee Wallace before you got into the spotlight. You know, what kind of movies did you enjoy watching and television shows did you enjoy watching when you were growing up?
Well, I come from a really poor household that was very ingrained in the Methodist religion. So we watched a lot of family programming, the Lassie. And so I was really totally jazzed in my career later on that I could do the new Lassie because I had grown up on Lassie. So it was close to my heart. And do you remember a show called The Hit Parade? And the Perry Como Show?
Perry Como Show.
And all those things. Well, you know, I started out as a dancer and really started my career doing some Broadway stuff. So I was just raised on all that. Those are the kind of shows, and Gunsmoke and The Lone Ranger and and all of that. Pretty much family style films. We got to go to the movies every once in a while, but we were pretty poor, so it was TV land for us to begin with. But as I started branching out, I guess, you know, romantic comedies and Hitchcock and things like that were the things that really drew me in as a young adult.
So obviously it was the Hitchcock and stuff like that. You said that that brought you in. But is there any particular actors that their performances maybe are what has inspired you or pushed you in that direction, saying, you know, that's what I want to do?
Oh my God, where could I even start? First of all, I think I was just born to do this. I'm sure I was an actress and dancers and many, you know, creative people in past lives, because all I want to do is create, whether it's writing or dancing or acting or healing.
So
I just
want to,
you know, work with the creation process. But Anthony Hopkins was a really big, Spencer Tracy, Katherine Hepburn, those are the, you know, the people that I grew up with that, not so much, interestingly enough, Elizabeth Taylor, but Joanne Woodward. Oh, my God, I watched Joanne Woodward, and I went, oh, I want to do what she does. I want to do that truthful work that she does. I remember seeing, what was it, the Five Faces of Eve or something that she did, you know, with the multi-personality thing, and I thought, oh, I want to do that. That's the kind of work I want to do.
And that was all it took, man. You saw that and you're like, that's it. I got to do it.
Well, yeah. And I mean, it just ignited something that was already there in me. And it was in there in me as a little girl. And I look at my daughter now and I see the same thing. It's like, yeah, well, this is just what she's here to do, you know? I think if we trust ourselves and follow that passion, that innate knowing within us, that things are created easily for us.
Now, when you obviously made that decision that that's the way you wanted to go, did you go through any special training? Did you go to a special acting school, or did you just take drama in high school, or how did that work?
Well, I took drama in high school. I actually had been given what we call elocution lessons when I was growing up, and learned a lot of humorous and dramatic readings, which now would be called monologues probably, and performed a lot, modeled a lot when I was younger. But my first real acting teacher was when I went to New York and studied with Uta Hagen. And I studied with Uta for 2 years and came out to L.A., studied with Jeff Corey, and then I met my mentor who changed my life, and his name was Charles Conrad, who was teaching what then was a revolutionary acting technique where you didn't look for beats and you didn't break down the script and you didn't, you know, pick it apart and study it and all that. You really read it once and got your energy to an extraordinarily high place, which now I know what that does is it opens your channel. So basically we were channeling characters and performances, and the work in that class was beyond amazing and exciting. And that's pretty much the technique I've used ever since. And it just gives you freedom. It gives you freedom to be in the moment and really go on the ride, which was what every actor wants. I mean, that's, you want the experience in the moment. When you have that, it's magic.
Awesome. Hey, tell me a little bit about the road to being in E.T. I mean, how did you get involved with what I consider, I mean, one of the most important films that I've ever seen, really, honestly. That film has touched the lives of literally every single person I know on the planet.
And it's a part of our culture, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Part of who we are. And, it was interesting. I was called in to audition for a little part called Used Cars. And fortunately, I did not get booked in that movie. But when it came to E.T., he remembered me from that audition and called and offered me the role of Mary in E.T., and that's how it came to me. Kind of a Hollywood story there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Kind of something that's meant to be. And, of course, now that I'm doing all the healing work that I'm doing, I go back and look at E.T. and go, well, you know, this is kind of the story of where we're all at, is keeping our heart open to get back to the home of who we really are. And it's just interesting to me how my life dovetails together between the acting and the healing constantly.
Now, I read in an interview that you had referred to E.T. as being your generation's version of the Wizard of Oz.
Absolutely. It's going to live forever. We're going to play it every year. It's going to touch, and already has, multiple generations. And most of all, it's the truth. Those two films tell the truth, that the power is within you all along. You have to keep your heart open, and you have to trust the world. And then the world comes through for you. You may have to go through, you know, some trials and tribulations here and there, but ultimately, if you believe in yourself, you get where you want to go. And that's a universal truth that we all know but we are tested in holding the belief in. And when we see movies like those two movies that really define that truth for us, it stays with us forever.
And it will. It absolutely will forever. As a matter of fact, there's a wooden plaque poster on the wall just not 2 feet from my right of from the movie E.T. in my studio.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, you know, who doesn't know you say phone home and everybody goes, yeah, E.T. You know?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's just a part of who we are. You know, I'll be right here. And the heart light and the magic. And it's a beautiful, beautiful film. And I'm very blessed to have been a part of it.
Now, do you still keep in touch with Henry Thomas and Drew Barrymore and the rest of the crew?
You know, I just did a sci-fi convention with the gentleman that played Michael. And I don't see Henry. I used to talk to him a lot more than I do now. And, you know, we of course, whenever there's an anniversary or anything, we see each other and get together. But it's kind of unfortunate in our business that it's a kind of a given. You come together in this closeness and you become so close and so trusting with everybody, and then poof, everybody goes on and creates another family somewhere else. And Ty Daly and I did a couple of things together and really, really liked each other. And we tried for a freaking year to have lunch together. It was just, you know, I mean, I think we finally were able... In Vegas, we found ourselves in Vegas one time together, and we actually could get together for dinner. And I mean, at one point, she sent out a mass letter to everybody going, I just want you to know you are my friend, and I do love you, but I'm shooting from 5 in the morning till 10 at night. And so just know when this is all over and I have some time, we'll get together. I mean, that's kind of an actor's life, you know. So you have to prioritize how you spend the little extra time you have, especially when you're doing a series.
Absolutely. Before we move on, one more question about E.T., one final question. Do you like Reese's Pieces?
Of course I like Reese's Pieces. Are you kidding? I am a chocoholic, baby.
All right.
And I am loving peanut butter, so I'm in heaven with those.
Awesome. Do they have, like, bowls of them on the sets and everything, or no, just the one bag that they use?
No, but wherever we go when we have a reunion and stuff, they always have them out.
So. Oh, sure.
And you know... I think that was offered. I'm not terribly positive, but I think that was offered to M&M's first.
Ooh, they messed up.
Yeah, well, a lot of people messed up. You know, it's like, no, we don't think we want to be associated with aliens. I'm sure whomever said that about whatever product in E.T. lost his job the day after it came out, right?
Right. Wow.
Like, how can you make such an idiotic decision?
Yeah. Nobody knows, though. You know, nobody knows what it's going to turn out like. You know, nobody had any idea that was going to have the impact that film had.
No, you can't. I mean, I remember when I was doing 10 with Blake Edwards, and I said, oh, Mr. Edwards, this is going to be such a big hit. He said, honey, if we knew what made a hit, we'd have a lot more of them.
You'd be lining them up one after the next.
Yeah, he was, you know, the most prolific writer, director, producer in Hollywood. People, you know, they remember him for Pink Panther, but they don't remember all the amazing dramatic work he did. And, I mean, he was just a genius. Bar none, and the nicest guy. I loved him. I just loved him.
Mm. Moving along to the movie The Howling, which you were in, obviously, with Miss Belinda Belaski. Tell us a little bit about the being in a horror film as opposed to being in the sci-fi films.
Oh, you know, a film is a film is a film, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you asked me the difference, the biggest difference would be the height of the emotional work. You know, a horror film is much more intense. You have to call up much more emotion. Even though E.T. had an amazing arc and a lot of emotional scenes in it, they were more quietly emotional than something like The Howling, where you were screaming and running and crying and, you know, gasping and all that stuff. So... and the other difference, of course, was I got to do The Howling with my beloved Christopher, whom we were engaged at the time. So that was a lot of fun. The Howling had, you know, much less money than E.T., obviously. But it was kind of like, let's put on a show. And you had all these amazing new talents, Joe Dante and John Sayles and me and Belinda, and, you know, Christopher had, at that point, my husband, or fiancé, was a pretty established actor at the time. But a lot of the components in that were, they were just newcomers. And very little money, but a hell of a lot of talent. And that little film sure holds up today. Is one of, I think, the best werewolf films ever.
It is without a doubt one of the scariest transformations that I've seen of a werewolf.
Yeah, you know, and today they, you know, go right to CGI and everything, and it's just different. Somebody sent me a thing that they're redoing Cujo, you know, and I went, you know, they're going to do CGI, it's going to look like shit, it's not going to be anything like it.
Right.
I don't understand. I understand redoing something that might get better. I don't understand redoing something like, well, Psycho, for example. I don't get it. It's like, and what would be the point of redoing The Wizard of Oz, right?
Right.
So, and I think we saw that. We tried to do something like The Wizard of Oz and make it more in and more hip and more modern, and nobody wanted to see it.
It's a very difficult thing for somebody to make something new without destroying what was old, and it's really hard to do that because you're going to lose people at the same time as trying to get people. So it's kind of a lose-lose, win-win.
Well, especially if it was done the best and in the highest way the first time.
Sure.
You know?
Now, when you're just speaking of Cujo there, too, it's, you know, between the werewolves and Cujo, you don't have very much luck with canines, do you?
I never heard it put that way. That's pretty funny. Big teeth and I don't get along, I guess. Although, you know, you could go a little further and go, well, D, you've worked with a lot of kids and dogs, and you know what they say about that. And I'd say, yeah, I wouldn't have had a career, right, if I hadn't worked with kids and dogs. So I would love to, you know, I would love to do some of the horror stuff on TV now. I don't get it. It's a no-brainer to me. I have such a huge following in this genre. And I'm not doing any of the horror TV stuff. It's just, okay, why? I don't get it, you know? So I would welcome some more canine teeth if the project's good.
Send them biters your way. Do you by chance have dogs?
I do. I have a beautiful white shepherd.
Ooh.
Yeah.
What color's the eyes?
Brown.
Oh, that sounds like a very beautiful dog. I've got three little dogs. I love my dogs.
Yeah, I'm all my animals are rescue animals, and they're all so appreciative, you know. It's like, oh, we have such a nice home, and we're so appreciative. We call her Velcro because I walk 5 inches, she walks 5 inches, you know.
Nice.
Like right now, she's just about a foot from me and never gets much further than that if I'm home. It's cute.
Yeah, it's like you can't even go.
A little neurotic, but cute.
You can't even go to the bathroom sometimes. I mean, you get up and go to the bathroom,
oh, no,
as you're closing the door, they're standing in the doorway.
She comes with me. We have moments at my toilet.
Now Cujo was that by breed was a Saint Bernard, correct?
Oh yes.
Okay, now was the Saint Bernard, you think, was chosen because that's kind of an unlikely villain? Like you would think of, you know, like a Rottweiler or a pit bull. You wouldn't think of a big lovable Saint Bernard.
Yeah, I think that's why Stephen did it. Sure. Was, you know, his commentary about what darkness can do to a natural situation. That's kind of a theme of his. And, yeah, I mean, Saint Bernards are probably the biggest and most lovable of the big dogs there are. And so for this to happen to a Saint Bernard is even more dramatically drastic and sad than if it were to happen to a pit bull. You kind of go, well, sure, yeah, it's a pit bull, right? So, boy, those dogs were amazingly well-trained. There were 5 dogs, all trained to go after toys. And Carl Miller, wow, he slept with those dogs, ate with those dogs, lived with those dogs during the entire shoot in the barn. He loved them so much and had them trained within an inch of their lives.
I'm sure they were all just big babies, too.
Yeah, big babies. Yeah. Absolutely.
It's amazing what the camera can do. You know, a little bit of, put a little mud on their nose, and a little saliva on the window, and some scary music and a bark, and all of a sudden it's a deadly creature, but it's just trying to play with you.
Yeah, he on action, he would go, dig for your toy, right? And that's how they got them to claw and bark and all that, but their tails were wagging the whole time, so we had to tie their tails down with fish wire.
Yeah, I would imagine.
There's a couple of shots in there that they left in where you can actually see them wagging their tails, but it kind of worked in the scene, you know?
Right, it was acceptable. They didn't have to go back. And, yeah. Just real quick here, tell me a little bit about what it was like to work with Michael J. Fox and the Frighteners.
Well, I can tell you Michael J. Fox is the sweetest and just kindest man. I wish I had more scenes with him. I didn't have a lot of scenes with Michael. And at that time, he was just starting to feel ill from, of course, what now we know is Parkinson's. But he was flying back and forth a lot to the States trying to figure out what the hell was going on with him. So I didn't get to spend a lot of time with him, and the time that I spent, he was just very lovely, very sincere, consummate professional, and just a really nice guy.
Yeah, I just saw some advertisement on TV the other day. He's coming out with the Michael J. Fox show, where he's playing, I don't know if he's playing himself or somebody who's like himself. With the Parkinson's stuff, but it's a comedy, and it looks really, it's going to be really good.
Well, I'm happy for him, and, you know, he's a great example to all of us that when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. You don't lay down, you don't become a victim, you don't give up. You go, okay, this is what I have to work with now, I'm going to create something else great. And that's what my work's all about, that's what my book Bright Light is all about. It's a really a history of my life and all my great films and directors and lots of stories, but woven through it also is the story of all the spiritual truths and how to create my life again that I learned through, you know, having some tough times in this business. And he's just a real testament to that.
Yeah, while we're on that, tell me our listeners a little bit about your radio show and how they can tune in and to hear a little bit about what you got to offer there.
Well, my radio shows, I have two call-in free radio shows, international, over the internet. You can find them at iamdwallace.com. That's my website, iamdwallace.com. And all my work is based on really empowering you, showing you how to create your life, showing you how you're not working with subconscious and unknown beliefs and belief systems, that once you get out of your way, man, we're just having amazing, amazing success with health and relationships and, you know, money flow in our lives and everything. So it's incredibly empowering work. It'll stoke your boat. We have lots of fun because, as you see, well, they kind of call me the irreverent healer. So both my shows, one of them's on Monday nights at 5 Pacific time and Thursday morning at 8 Pacific time. And again, you can find out the archives or how to call in at imdwallace.com.
Yeah, and I listened to one of your shows, and it's very uplifting. It's very, I don't know how to explain it. I felt much better when once it was over.
Well, great. Thanks.
It made me feel good about myself.
Well, and that's the most important thing we can do is feel, when we feel good about ourselves and really love ourselves, our lives can start creating themselves in a much bigger way. But of course, we're never taught to love ourselves. We're taught to give ourselves up for everybody else so they'll love us. And it ain't the answer.
I'm going to ask you my signature question that I ask all of my guests.
Uh-oh.
Oh, yeah. It's a good one. Here it comes. Out of all the interviews you've done, what is the one question that you wanted somebody to ask or thought you would have been asked, and yet, as of yet, have not been asked that question?
Oh, my God. You should email this to us ahead of time.
I can edit it, trust me.
I guess is, you know, I've got a $10 million film. Do you want to do it?
Yeah, that's a good question to be asked.
Well, you know, I've never, ever had an interviewer say, I got a gig for you, Dee. Do you want to do it?
All right. Well, good answer. Good answer then.
If I had to be cute and clever, that's what it would be.
Well, you have to be cute and clever. It's in your nature.
I'm naturally so, darling.
Now, you're going to be at Motor City Nightmares again this year, correct?
I believe I have a standing invitation there, yes.
Excellent. Okay, so everybody make sure that you go out to Motor City Nightmares again this year, which I'm sure it's going to be in Novi again. It's always in Novi. So make sure you go and check her out. I do thank you very much for joining me on the show today. It's been a delight, as I was told it would be.
Thank you, Donnie. It was great to be with you. Thank you so much. Have a great day, everybody.
Perfect. I thank you very much. This has been
wonderful. You're welcome, baby cake. Thank you.
You have a great and fantastic day.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.